Hi, I'm Neil Stavem. I want to thank you for listening to this podcast from Connecting Faith. There are many more podcasts available at our website, myfaithradio.com, and your support makes this possible.
Always expect something good on your lunch hour. Connecting Faith with Life.
Well, good afternoon. Welcome to Connecting Faith. Thanks for joining us this afternoon. I'm Joe Bender and excited to have a conversation today with an author whom I read when I was a student at Northwestern about the subject of apologetics and talking to people about their faith, about what we believe, and hopefully engaging them in a conversation about what they might believe. So years ago when I took this class, I said, that guy needs to come on my show, and I'm very excited for him to join us today. Here's what we're going to talk about. Let me ask you this question. Have you ever been asked a question that seemed like it was a little bit, well, maybe threatening or a little bit skeptical from someone who was not a follower of Christ? Like, what right do you have to convert others to your views? Or maybe this one, it doesn't matter what you believe as long as you're sincere. Why can't I believe what I want to believe? Well, the title of my guest book that we're going to talk about today is True for You, but Not for Me. Maybe you've had that conversation with someone as well. Can something be true for you, but not for me? Well, we're going to get down to answer some of these questions, as well as just hopefully have some responses to what happens if someone is asking you maybe kind of a threatening question about your faith. How can you keep that conversation going so you can get to the point where you can talk about who Christ is to you and why it is that you follow him so that we can ultimately bring others to know him as well? Let me tell you about my author, my guest for today, and we will get started with the show. Paul Copan has his PhD from Marquette University. He's the Pledger Family Chair of Philosophy and Ethics at Palm Beach Atlantic University. He's authored several books, including True for You, But Not for Me, When God Goes to Starbucks, and also Is God a Moral Monster? So we're going to talk about many of these subjects, hopefully, and just get your questions coming in as well. Paul, welcome to the show.
Thanks so much, Joe. Great to be with you.
Well, it's great to have you here. And a lot of the hot topics today is we're talking about maybe religious skepticism or really just tolerance seems to be a buzzword as well, has to do with that word of relativism. Can you explain what relativism is and how that kind of sets us up for having these conversations that may be a little confusing?
Sure. Of course, the book title tries to summarize this, you know, true for you, but not for me. And what it is assuming is that truth is relative to a particular person or a particular culture, that it doesn't, it's not objective, that it is not true for everyone across the board. So you'll have people say, well, this is just my perspective. But once you start to say, well, this is the truth of the matter, then people start to get a little nervous because they're assuming that your view is that there is truth for all people, and that if you disagree with that, then you would be in error. And of course, many people find that offensive. They think that that is intolerant and so forth. And of course, you know, these sorts of things are loaded words, and we need to unpack them. But so often there's a lot of emotional language. You know, there's a lot of emotion and this idea of offense that so many people are sensitized to. And but when you actually buy into it, you find yourself immobilized because the kind of language that you're assuming, the kind of definitions that you're assuming, are fraught with all kinds of contradictions. So it is actually going to be very helpful for us as we go through this process during this hour, and as, you know, again, as we go into these conversations, to have people define their terms. So relativism, again, has to do with this notion that you can have all kinds of different truths, and even if they conflict with one another, well, that doesn't matter because, you know, again, because you're sincere, or just what matters is that you're tolerant, that there is no, you have to accept all views as true. So you'll have that kind of a jumble of ideas. But again, relativism has to do with the idea that a truth is relative to a particular person, to a particular culture, and that it is not something that is universally binding. upon another person as though that person needs to accept it. And if he doesn't, then he would be in error. He would be wrong or something like that. So that's the general landscape there.
So if we're going on that line of reasoning, then for someone to say that if you establish that there is one truth, then you are wrong, talk us around how that argument can't possibly stand up, because for that statement to be true, then that statement would be wrong, correct?
Exactly. Well, let me give an example that might help shed light here. One of my daughters was in school, and her teacher was in high school, and the teacher asked the students, about 30 students, how many of you think that there's no such thing as truth? And 28 out of 30, they raised their hands. And she asked one young man who didn't raise his hand, why didn't you raise your hand? And he didn't really know what to say. And so she asked my daughter, Valerie, why didn't you raise your hand? And my daughter said, well, if you say that there's no such thing as truth, you're basically saying that it's true, that there is no truth, and that's a contradiction. And the teacher said, you're exactly right. But yet, you know, so many people in her class and throughout our culture, they buy into this idea that there's no such thing as truth, and, you know, that is true, something that is true for all people. But I think that it might help us to gain clarity here, not only by seeing that this is self-contradictory, to say that it's true that there is no truth is itself contradictory. But we also need to remember that a lot of people who call themselves relativists will also tack on to their relativistic line some sort of objective moral value or some sort of absolute that is true for all people. So, for example, you'll hear people say, you can do whatever you want, but they don't like to leave it there. They don't like to be relativists. They actually have to add some sort of an objective moral value, some sort of command after that.
Like as long as it's not hurting other people.
Just as long as it's between two consenting adults, or just as long as you don't hurt anyone, or just as long as you are tolerant of other people. Well, why add that? You're adding this moral rule to this relativistic statement that you can do whatever you want, that's just true for you, etc. Well, the fact that they're adding this on implies that they actually don't hold relativism to be true in all of its full colors, that they have to limit it somehow, that relativism has to be selective. And so I tell people that relativists tend to be selective when it comes to their own viewpoint, that they believe that truth or, you know, morality are relative, that when it comes to God or right and wrong, people aren't going to be relativists about who won the Super Bowl. They're not going to say, this team won for you, but the other team won for me. They're not going to talk that way. We don't talk about relativism when we read the ingredients on labels. We're not relativists when it comes to prescriptions on medicine bottles. You know, we're just relativists when it comes to, you know, God and morality, basically. So I think it's helpful to know that people are selective relativists, that they're not relativists across the board. And I think this can help us to get our foot in the door to talk about truth related to God or truth related to morality, that it's not merely a matter of opinion here.
Well, and part of relativism, a relativist would also say that we can't know anything, correct?
Well, relativists will tend to say that. I mean, we could kind of, now we're going into kind of a skepticism where they'll actually notice this. They're making a knowledge claim, saying you cannot know, or basically, we know that we can't know, which again ends up being self-contradictory. So a lot of people, they don't realize that when they reject truth, they're affirming the truth. When they deny knowledge, they're actually affirming knowledge. Let me again just recap that if you say that there is no truth, you're saying that it's true that there is no truth. If you're saying that you can't know, you're making a knowledge claim. You're saying, I know that you can't know. And it ends up being a self-contradictory. Now, we are creatures who have been made in the image of God, who have been made with rational capacities to seek after the truth, to be able to know things. And so when we reject the very image of God that has made us, that enables us to be truth-seeking beings, that enables us to be knowing beings, we are actually undermining something at the very core of our being as humans. It undermines our very humanity to reject truth and knowledge.
So break that down to, if we are talking about our belief in Christ or belief that there is a God, and someone says, well, you can't know that there is a God, what might be a proper response?
Well, I would just simply say, well, maybe you don't know, but how do you know that I don't know? I mean, you know, it just seems that you're making a sweeping claim about knowledge, and I want to know how you can justify that sort of a claim. And instead of you're having, as a Christian, having to bear the burden of proof by, okay, well, I'm going to show how you can know, say, well, how do you know that you can't know? Because, you know, the person who's making a knowledge claim ought to be able to justify why he is making this sweeping claim that you can't know. And so let that person bear the burden of proof. And the person might say, well, the arguments for God's existence don't work. Well, you can say, well, maybe the arguments for God's existence don't work, but that doesn't mean that maybe a person can't have personal insight into God's existence that maybe nobody else can get in on. What if God whispers in my ear, and even if no one else can get in on the secret, how do you know that I can't know this? You know, how do you know that I can't have an experience with God, even if you haven't? Mm-hmm. So again, to rule it out utterly, you know, that's making quite a sweeping claim. And so, you know, we could, of course, talk about arguments for God's existence and so forth. But for a person to say, you can't know, I'd want to know how he knows that.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Paul Copan is my guest today. And Dr. Copan, I just want you to be standing next to me, whispering in my ear when I have these conversations. That's how I would have a better conversation, I think.
Okay.
Dr. Copan is going to join me after the break today, but we're talking about his book, True for You, But Not for Me, Overcoming Objections to the Christian Faith. We'll bring up a couple more objections and figure out what would be a good way for us to answer, again, to not be divisive, but to actually draw people into having a conversation about what it is that Christ followers do believe about God and about Jesus Christ. We'll talk more about that coming up in Connecting Faith. Welcome back to Connecting Faith. I'm Joe Bender. Thanks for joining us this afternoon. My guest today is Dr. Paul Copan. He is a Pledger Family Chair of Philosophy and Ethics at Palm Beach Atlantic University, and he's written a great book that we studied in my apologetics class that says, True for You, But Not for Me, Overcoming Objections to Christian Faith. And we've been talking a bit about relativism and the position that all points of view are equally valid, and that all truth is relative to the individual. And a lot of times, Paul, that position is combined with this word called tolerance. Can you talk about what is it that culture believes about tolerance, and is that definition correct? Relatively speaking, of course.
Yes. Tolerance used to be defined, the classical definition, as putting up with what one finds disagreeable or false or erroneous. So there was something negative to it. You put up with, say, someone who thinks differently than you do. You put up with, say, Brussels sprouts when someone serves them to you, even though you don't like them, you tolerate them. We don't tolerate things like chocolate or the music of Bach. You know, we don't tolerate beautiful sunsets. We enjoy them. But yet there has come to be in our own culture this notion that tolerance means embracing, accepting, celebrating. But if you accept all beliefs as true, if you celebrate them all, well, what do you do when you've got the Buddhist who doesn't believe in God and the Christian who does, and you say, well, I accept both those views? Well, you can't accept that God exists and that God doesn't exist. This is a contradiction. So that's one of the problems with defining relativism as, tolerance as accepting all views as true.
So accepting is not necessarily the definition of tolerance, but it definitely seems as if that's what people are expecting when they mention the word tolerant. Well, you just need to be tolerant of whatever someone believes to be true. And that doesn't mean we need to accept what someone says to be true. Am I understanding that correctly?
there are beliefs that we may, you know, all disagree with, and it's kind of interesting that the person who is allegedly intolerant, well, the person who claims to be tolerant in this modern definition isn't accepting of his views. So is he being intolerant? Well, you know, of course not. I think it just makes a confusion between accepting a person, even though we reject the beliefs that he holds. And I think that this, that what the relativist does is collapse the two, the person and the belief. So if you don't accept my views, you're not accepting me. And what we need to do is affirm to, you know, that there's a difference between a person and his beliefs, that we can love and accept and show kindness to people who disagree with us, or as we will sometimes say, we can just agree to disagree. But again, it shows a spirit of goodwill there, and that's the true sense of tolerance, where we, even though we disagree, that is, we don't accept all views as true. And we need to remember, too, that no one can accept all views as true, because if you disagree, the person who is the who thinks he's so tolerant by accepting all views, he's not going to accept the what he takes to be a narrow-minded, bigoted view. Mm-hmm. No, he's going to reject that. So again, accepting all views becomes impossible, mm-hmm. even for the most tolerant, in the modern sense of the word, person. So what we can do, though, is say, you know, that we are distinguishing between a person and the beliefs that the person holds. And frankly, there are some beliefs that we should not embrace. Do we want to say, sometimes people say, I really respect your beliefs. And, you know, those beliefs may be, terrible. I don't respect the belief that rape is morally neutral. Some people may hold that, but I don't say, I really respect your beliefs. No, what I mean is I respect you as a human being. I strongly disagree with your views. I would oppose them in court, et cetera. But again, I can acknowledge that this person has dignity and worth because he's been made in the image of God. And this becomes the basis of a true tolerance, where we, even though we disagree with a person, we can still show forbearance to another person, that we can still show goodwill to another person. So the relativist, however, doesn't he because he collapses belief and person, he ends up creating all sorts of self-contradictions for himself. But true tolerance means it has something negative built into it that you don't approve of, that you don't like, that you find something erroneous, but yet you are willing to put up with that sort of a thing at a personal level. Of course, there are some things that we don't tolerate and we shouldn't tolerate, like rape and murder and so forth. And we can say, yeah, these are bad things that ought to be resisted. And if people perpetrate these sorts of crimes, then we ought to put them in jail. So those are the sorts of things that we need to also bring into the picture, that there are some things that should not be tolerated. That we come to a certain level where people are actually harmed, where people are abused, where people are dehumanized, and we say, okay, when you can call me nasty things, but when you start actually harming people, we need to step in and stop you.
So it seems along that line of reasoning that someone who is a Christian would actually be possibly a little bit better at separating what someone believes from that person, given that we believe that people are made in the image of God. And so to be able to separate those two things seems essential in not sounding as if you are being judgmental.
Exactly. Yeah, I think the Christian is precisely and properly positioned by being able to affirm the value and dignity of a person, even though there is disagreement. And the relativist has no wiggle room here. If he's defining tolerance as accepting all views as true, it's self-contradictory, and it's just a flawed understanding of what it means to be tolerant. You know, we're tolerant with people we put up with. We accept them as persons. We recognize that they have a right to think differently, but that doesn't mean that we have to accept or respect or embrace their beliefs.
So it's really not about winning arguments. And I know sometimes Christians are accused of wanting to win the argument. I am right about what I believe. But what should we instead be concerned about when we're having a conversation with someone who might disagree with our beliefs?
Well, again, it's first of all important to remember that this is a person who is God's image bearer, someone for whom Christ has died, someone who is not simply a person who has certain ideas, but someone who is looking for some sort of an anchor or some sort of stability in the wrong places. He's the relativist is maybe putting trust in a relationship or putting trust in something that he thinks is going to give him ultimate satisfaction. But this relativist, in all likelihood, probably has some trust issues when it comes to authority. And so once you start bringing God or morality into the picture, maybe because there's been a misuse of authority, because maybe there's been a pastor or a parent who calls himself a Christian but yet is very abusive, has been very wrong in how he's handled his authority, then people can become very gun shy and very, very untrusting of authority. And I think that the first step that we ought to look to pursue is building trust with the relativist. A study was done of various university students who had held this view of truth as being relative to eventually becoming believers. And this process was tracked, and really the first, and this is, you can read about this in the book I Once Was Lost, by two InterVarsity Christian Fellowship staff workers on university campuses, and they said that the first threshold that people who are relativists need to get over is the barrier of distrust, moving from distrust to trust. And it's usually when Christians step into this gap that has been created where they are people of trust, trustworthiness, that they are faithful, that they are people of good character, that this is often the open door for people to think, well, maybe there is something to this truth thing. Maybe there is something to this right and wrong thing and virtuous character and so forth, because I'm seeing this model before me. It looks beautiful. It makes sense. I want to be like that person. Those are the sorts of things that we need to, I think, first approach, where we treat the relativist as someone who is a very needy person, someone who doesn't just need to be, we think, oh, we just need to shake him up with showing how self-contradictory his views are, but in all likelihood, there's been a personal failure here, that there's been some relational failure, there's been a breakdown in authority. And of course, if God is the cosmic authority, and this person has authority problems and so rejects authority and hides behind this relativism, then we need to be those who are actually bridges to pointing people to a God who can be trusted, because they, as God's witnesses, as representatives of Jesus Christ, can also be trusted. They are a safe place to be. And so this is going to be the first step that people are often going to need to take in order to move toward belief in God.
Talking with Paul Copan today about his book, True for You, But Not for Me, Overcoming Objections to Christian Faith. We're going to open up the lines for questions or callers coming up after the break. We'd love to hear your question. If you want, give us a call at 877-93-FAITH, 877-933-2484. We'll be back in a minute. Welcome back to Connecting Faith. I'm Joe Bender. Thanks for listening to us this afternoon. My guest for today is Dr. Paul Copan. He is the chair of philosophy and ethics at Palm Beach Atlantic University, has authored several books, including When God Goes to Starbucks. He lives with his wife and five children in West Palm Beach, Florida. And today we're talking about his book, True for You, But Not for Me, Overcoming Objections to Christian's Faith. So if you've had some conversations with people where they've objected your faith or objected your beliefs, this is a great show for you to listen to. And maybe you have some questions of your own. Maybe you want to share a conversation that's taken place in your life. I'm sure that Paul would be happy to answer some of those questions. You can call us at 877-93-FAITH. That's 877-933-2484. We also have a couple of his books to give away as He and his publisher have been very generous, and we would love to get those in your hands. If you're interested in the subject of relativism, tolerance, and anything in between, learning how to answer these objections to your faith. Paul, we did have someone write in a question. I'd love to read that to you and have you respond. An anonymous caller said, "My brother and I have had a conversation about how we are all put on this earth for a greater purpose, but he disagrees, saying that one does not need a specific purpose or meaning in order to live. Animals do it all the time," he said. "So as a Christian, how can I explain that God does have a purpose, not only for us, but for animals too?"
Well, I'll try to keep it keep the big picture here. It's very interesting that the very question that is being discussed has purpose written all over it. So do we need a purpose? Well, I'm saying we already have purpose, you know, stamped on every facet of our lives. Notice the very question. It was asked. Doesn't God give to us purpose and so forth? Well, the response was, well, do we even need a purpose? Well, to what purpose was that being asked? Was that the brother responding to the question in a purposeless way? No, he was responding very purposefully. We are creatures who ask why questions all the time, don't we? Why is there something rather than nothing? Or the atheist will ask, why does evil exist if there's a good God? We use logical laws that are actually directed toward a purpose, namely toward the truth. If we're simply molecules in motion that ultimately have no purpose, that if we are the products, as the atheist will say, of these blind deterministic forces over which we have no control, then, you can talk about there being no cosmic purpose and so forth. You know, that makes sense. But even the very attempt to exert your free will toward a certain end, I think a lot of people, even though they will talk about having this view of just being the products of molecules in motion, they act in a very way that does not suggest that they believe themselves to be molecules in motion, the products of non-rational forces. No, they're speaking with intentionality. They're speaking with a presumed rationality. Why does this brother think that his viewpoint is more rational than his sister's viewpoint? Now, again, all of this is not the product of molecules in motion. It sounds like someone has a rational mind. It sounds like this person's beliefs aren't just pumped into him by these blind materialistic forces over which he has no control, but rather he is very purposeful in answering these questions. And so my question is broader. Where do you even get this idea of purpose, talking about purpose in a purposeless world? Where do we get this idea of rationality in a purposeless world? Where do we get this idea of logical laws that we follow, that we seek the truth with these laws? Where do we get that in a purposeless world? It sounds like everything, you know, that we are talking about here goes against this notion that we're just dealing with purposelessness here. So we are stamped with purpose, is my point. And so I think it's important to look at these broader categories that enable us to think about rationality and purpose and so forth. So that's where I would begin. You see, people tend to borrow from the Christian worldview or a biblical worldview in order to make sense of their own lives. They can't live with the inconsistency of being merely molecules in motion, of being the products of these blind, deterministic, purposeless forces. No, we're always dealing with purposeful conversation. We believe that our conversation has meaning, that our words mean things, and so forth. Where does that come from if we're simply the products of molecules in motion? You've got to borrow from a worldview like theism, because you can't find it given an atheistic or naturalistic world.
Mm. Well, speaking of theism, one of the questions that you address in your book and one of the questions that people probably receive all the time is the statement that all religions are basically the same. So when someone comes to you with, well, that's nice if that's what you believe, but really all religions are basically the same, what is a good way to engage that person in conversation?
I would simply say, well, what religions have you actually studied in order to be able to make that sort of a claim? Because people who study religions, in fact, one leading pluralist, John Hick, he died a few years ago, but he he believed that all religions are capable of bringing salvation or liberation. But one thing that he was very clear on was that if you study the religions, even superficially, you recognize that they are very, very different at just fundamental points. So, you know, the Buddhist, for example, believes that suffering is the result of humans' desire, that humans, you know, they latch onto things. Well, the Christian says, no, we ought to latch onto God, that suffering is not something that is a result of craving. Yes, we can bring suffering upon ourselves because we crave the wrong things. You know, so even at that fundamental level of what is the, you know, human problem, we can talk about who are human beings, what is the fundamental feature of human nature, where did we come from, where are we going, what happens in the afterlife, what is the human problem, what is the solution to that problem, what is the nature of ultimate reality. All of these things are fundamentally different when you look at the various religions of the world. So when a person says they're all basically the same, that is simply not a well-informed statement that is being made. And I would just simply say, well, you know, just I think if you look at the various religions of the world, you see that they are fundamentally different when it comes to the afterlife, when it comes to the human problem, the solution to the human problem, the nature of ultimate reality. Is it personal? Is it impersonal? And so forth. So again, there's a wide range of things to point out. And I would say, I think a little more study, shows that there are significant differences, and they can't all be true. So we need to, I think, land on that they can all be true. And some people might say, well, how do you figure it all out? Well, when you look at the world of religions, and you look at the various proponents, maybe the world's religious leaders like Muhammad and Buddha and Confucius, and you look at the kind of claims that they make, well, you look at Jesus and you see him standing head and shoulders above everyone else when it comes to the identity claims that are being made. Jesus is saying, the one who has seen me has seen the Father, that he is the Lord of the Sabbath, that he is the one who, come to me, not my teaching or something, come to me and I will give you rest. You know, Jesus has the water that can quench our spiritual thirst. So Jesus is making all of these claims to be able to forgive people and so forth. You know, again, like no other world religious leader. And to add to this, Jesus' followers worship him for being one who made those claims. And why did they worship him? Well, because his body didn't remain in the tomb. The Christian faith has no relics, as it were, that there was no body remaining in the tomb. And because Jesus rose from the dead, and there is historical evidence for this, we have confirmation that the claims that Jesus made about himself are indeed true. And again, this is remarkably different from any other world religious leader who is not making the same identity claims and whose bodies have not come back from the dead.
Well, and one of the objections to Christianity along that line is that Jesus is exclusive in saying, I'm the way, the truth, and the life. No one will come to the Father except through me. Not everyone will make it to heaven. And so it seems that one of the objections is, well, why would God be so exclusive? What's a way to engage that person in that conversation and to answer that question as well?
Yeah. Well, I would say that it is the person who is being exclusive. That person is excluding God from his own life. That basically, it's not because people are born at the wrong place or at the wrong time. No, God commands all people everywhere to repent, Paul says in Romans, in Acts 17, when he's speaking to the Athenians, that God is not far from each one of us, but he commands all of us to repent. He's telling us that, you know, that there is this obligation that we have to repent, and that if that's the case, then God would make salvation available to all people. The problem is, though, as C.S. Lewis said, in the end, there are two kinds of people. Those who say to God, thy will be done, and those to whom God says, thy will be done. Mm-hmm. So God gives to human beings the opportunity to reject him or to embrace him. It's actually, the Christian will say, it's actually those who reject God who are being exclusive. They're not including God in their lives. And so God says, okay, have it your way. You get your divorce from me. If you don't want God, you get no God. And so that's really how it works. I think if we look at it in this bigger picture, we start to see that it's actually human beings who have choices to make, that God is not willing that any should perish, but that all come to repentance. And so the question is, you know, what do you do with the claim of God upon your life? Do you reject it? Do you embrace it? And so, yes, we can talk about, well, what about the unevangelized and so forth? And I do go into detail about that in my book. But you know, I think at that fundamental level, we need to understand that human beings have a choice to embrace the God who reveals himself or to say, no, I don't want you as the authority in my life.
Well, and again, that might be a great way to, like you said earlier, ask the person asking you that question to bear the burden of proof there. What is it about Christianity that makes it seem exclusive to you? Why do you say that? And to be asking those questions, is that a way to understand their viewpoint a little more and be able to better answer questions?
Sure, yeah. It's always important that we be asking questions. I mean, James 1:19 says, let everyone be quick to listen and slow to speak. And very often we flip those around. We're very quick to speak, very slow to listen. And a lot of times the objections that people have are not really objections at all. And we find that we can, you know, even in many ways agree with people. We can find ourselves in hearty agreement that their problems that they've had in the Christian community, maybe they've had a bad experience in the church. We can say, you know, I've had those same sorts of experiences too. I don't agree with what was done to you, and I don't agree what was done to me. But you know what? The truth supersedes our own experiences, and so we need to actually look beyond our own experiences. So we need to be good listeners. And so I think we need to then, in light of that, you know, we need to ask questions like, you know, is there, you know, I mean, how serious are you about the truth? I mean, if the truth is truth, it's got to exclude something. Mm. You know, I mean, 2 + 2 = 4. I mean, we don't seem to have a problem with truth, this truth excluding 5, 6, 7, 8 and so forth. No, we recognize that truth is limited. When we take tests in school, you know, it's not as though anyone's answer goes and the teacher can pass everyone. No, there is a reality to which our lives need to conform. And frankly, if we don't want to give up our sin, what the Bible calls repentance, well, then how could God accept us? You know, a lot of people will be resisting God's claim upon their lives, not because of intellectual reasons, but often for moral reasons, that they don't want God to be in charge of their lives. And so, and that's why we talked about relativism in this way. I think people are motivated to embrace relativism because they don't want any sort of authority over them. Now, this doesn't disprove relativism. Don't get me wrong here. Relativism has enough problems logically, in itself to, But what we're saying here is that the issue goes beyond merely intellectual questions to actually matters that are much more profound, matters of the heart, saying, I was wrong, saying I need help, abandoning human pride, abandoning human sin, and turning to God. This is a huge issue. And I would add, too, that God makes himself available to people. That, you know, I've met people who are from a Muslim background who have become followers of Christ. They've told me about the visions that they had of Jesus and how they came to faith in Jesus Christ, you know, prompted by these visions. And so, you know, it's not as though people are just left without a witness. Paul says, no, God has not left himself without a witness in Acts chapter 14, that God is, you know, already there in many places, you know, through creation, through conscience, through events in people's lives that awaken them to their need for outside assistance, what we call grace. You know, we need God to step into our lives. So as long as we're self-reliant, as long as we think that we are the ones who are in charge of our destiny, as long as we think that we've got to merit our own future, then we're going to be lost. But we need mercy. We need outside assistance. We need grace. And for those who cast themselves upon God's mercy, however, you know, faint that may be, that understanding of God, you know, God is not far from each one of us, and we need to remember that.
All the more reason to continue the conversation when someone brings up something about belief in God or the beliefs that we hold. All the more reason to just have that conversation and remain open to it. Dr. Paul Copan is my guest today. We're talking about his book, True for You, But Not for Me, Overcoming Objections to Christian Faith. We still have, I think, one or two books to give away. If you'd like to get a copy in your hands or the hands of someone else, give us a call at 877-933-2484, 877-933-2484. We'll be right back on Connecting Faith.
Theo.
Connecting Faith. Thanks for joining us today for this conversation. We're talking about overcoming objections to Christian faith with Dr. Paul Copan, who's written a book called True for You, But Not for Me. Maybe you've had those kinds of conversations with people who are questioning, well, why do we have to believe what you believe? How do you know that what you believe is actually true? And one of my favorites, which you address in your book, Dr. Copan, is, who are you to impose your morality on others? That seems to be a kind of a hot button issue as well. How do we respond to that kind of question? Who are you to impose your morality on others?
Well, notice the assumption here that to do so would be morally wrong, that there is some sort of a standard that is being violated if you do that. It's always wrong. To impose your morality on others, but then we have to ask the question, where did that moral standard come from? Notice in the attempt to try to evade moral authority, people are setting themselves up as the moral authorities that we ought to listen to. It's sort of like this idea, question authority, that you see on bumper stickers. Well, notice the bumper sticker itself is making an authoritative statement. Question authority. Now, I think we can appreciate how they are saying that a lot of people are claiming authority and they shouldn't be listened to and so forth. I understand that. But the very authoritative statement that comes from that bumper sticker to question authority, we have to ask, well, where did that authority come from to question authority? Presumably, you know, again, it comes back to the question of, you know, we can't escape some kind of an authority. Either there's going to be some authority external to us, or we're going to be our own authority. Well, why should we choose ourselves over something external to us? And I'd say, why choose something that is, you know, like God, who has made us in his image, who has made us to thrive when we are actually following in the ways of God? It makes more sense to actually live in keeping with that moral authority than to defy it. But again, the very notion it's wrong to impose moral values on others, that itself is a moral standard that is being presupposed. But we can also add to that, aren't we grateful that morality is being imposed all the time on criminals, for example, on rapists, on murderers, and so forth, that if they violate a certain law, that they will be punished, that they will be put in jail or whatever. And we can say, you know, we talk about moral reforms in this way. When slavery was abolished, it was because a certain moral standard was being imposed, and we can say, thank the Lord for that. You know, William Wilberforce had courage to stand up against the slave trade. That there have been all kinds of moral reforms that have taken place. Well, this presupposes that morality is not invented; it is discovered. And so we cannot escape this moral authority. And even the person who says, well, you know, who are you to impose your moral values on others? That person himself is making a certain morally authoritative statement. And we have to ask the question, well, where did that come from? You cannot escape this kind of moral authority.
How about if someone takes that a step further and says, well, people can be good and moral without God. Why do we need God to help us establish what's good or moral?
Well, we need to understand this at two levels. At the level of knowing, yes, I would agree. We don't need to believe in God in order to know moral truths. But I'd say, how do we come to be moral beings? Now, notice that this statement presupposes that human beings have personal responsibility, that human beings have dignity and worth, that they have certain moral duties and so forth. Notice all of that is bound up in this statement. So, yeah, they can know these things, but the reason that they have all of these features of dignity and worth and personal responsibility and free will and so forth is that they have been made in the image of God. The more basic question is, how did we come to be that way? How did we come to be moral beings? So a person says, oh, I already know that rape is wrong. Well, yes, you may know that rape is wrong even without belief in God, but what gives that person who could be potentially the rape victim, what gives that person her dignity and worth so that she shouldn't be raped? And where does the authority come from, you know, the duty come from, that I should not engage in these sorts of activities? You know, so there's much more to the package than just simply saying, oh, I know moral truth even though I don't believe in God. Now, the question is, how did you come to be an intrinsically valuable being in the first place? Is it from a whole string of series of mindless, material, valueless processes? Or have you been made by a supremely valuable being that gives you value? it makes a lot better sense to say that value comes from value rather than that somehow through these valueless processes of, you know, from the Big Bang until today, that value has somehow been produced. So I would go about it in that way.
Hmm. Well, I hate that there's only about 5 minutes left of our program because I really want you to just touch on briefly the question that you spend quite a bit of time on in your book, which is, if Jesus is the only way to God, what about those who have never heard him? Can you kind of give us an outline of what someone might want to study or look at if they were going to be able to answer that type of question? Because it comes up a lot.
Sure. Well, I would say, first of all, read part five of the book, True for You and Not for Me.
Mm-hmm.
Secondly, we need to understand that God isn't willing that any should perish, but that all should come to repentance. And if that's the case, we need to understand that God has not somehow made a mistake by placing people in the wrong place or at the wrong time. God knows the hearts of all people, and if there is genuine sincerity there, it's not as though God owes a person now because that person is sincere, but rather that sincerity is actually the outworking of God's grace already at work in that person's life. And also, God knows how to go beyond the boundaries of where human missionaries have not gone. God is able to speak to people's hearts even where the gospel has not come. And so we're hearing stories all the time of people in the Muslim world and so forth who are seeing visions of Jesus and so forth and who are responding to what they're seeing even though a missionary hasn't gotten there. So it's important for us to remember that God has his ways, even if we don't know them, that God has the problem of the unevangelized figured out. And so with these sorts of things in mind, with God's heart for the world, God's concern that all find salvation, that none perish, that God has made provision, that God has gone to such great lengths for our salvation, surely he hasn't just somehow made a mistake about the unevangelized, those who've never heard of Jesus. No, God will do right by them, that the judge of the earth will do right by them. And so God is the one who desires for salvation, desires for all people to be saved. And so with that in mind, we can embrace a God who is trustworthy. After all, look at how far he's gone, to the depths that he's gone for our salvation. If God is willing to go to those depths, surely he can be trusted with the question of the unevangelized.
Mm. It helps us to kind of take the pressure off of having to know the answer for all things instead of just knowing that God does know the answer of all things and we can trust him to be able to manage his world the way that he sees fit. And it helps us not to have to take on that burden.
Indeed. Well put.
Well, Paul, we just thank you so much for being able to join us today, and I really encourage people, if you have been listening and you want to be able to answer some of these questions on your own, pick up a copy of Paul's book, True for You But Not for Me, Overcoming Objections to Christian Faith, and also the book, When God Goes to Starbucks, also a great conversation starter, and just a way for you to kind of feel like you at least can draw people in when a skeptic may ask a question. Our intent as Christ followers is to draw them in, find out where that question comes from, and be able to just make them interested in what we believe, who God is, and how God could possibly be a solution or an answer in their life as well. So I hope you enjoyed the conversation today. Paul Copan, thanks so much for joining us.
Great to be with you. Thanks so much, Joe.
Absolutely. And you've been listening to Connecting Faith. If you jumped in on part of the conversation but you want to hear more, you can go to myfaithradio.com. Click on Connecting Faith, and you'll be able to catch a podcast of this program and many others if you just go online. Otherwise, thanks for joining us this afternoon. Have a wonderful Friday.